everybody's ready, we'll get started, okay?
Launch.
All right, well, here we go, guys. Three, two.
Wait a minute. Andrew's
like sucking water.
I was fine.
Water's all right. It's legit.
Here we are. Three, two. Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the study of the early Christian movement and its implications for the church today. Today we are with Michael, a resident ephesiologist, Andrew Johnson, associate pastor at Neartown Church in Houston, Texas. I'm Matt Till, lead pastor of Restoration Church in the Chicago suburbs. And man, we have this special privilege today that we have an opportunity to interview Alan Hirsch, all the way from Australia. And the other side, we've coordinated the time. So Alan, we're so glad you're here. Alan is an author. He's also a founder of 100 Movements, 5Q, the Forge Network, and I think about a gajillion other things that you do.
Yeah, and what haven't you done, Alan?
I don't know, man. You feel like you'd like to do a whole lot more, right?
Yeah.
Well, Alan, it's so good to have you with us, and we're grateful for this opportunity to talk with you today. Alan, just for our audience, could you just kind of expand a little bit more about perhaps what you do and what you've been doing for the state of the church and just some of the work that you've been a part of.
Yeah. So like, I guess, my own journey to this part, point to at today, came about from being a kind of inner city church planter in Melbourne, Australia, where we were tussling with what does it mean in the breakdown, the whole postmodern breakdown in society into a whole lot of tribal, kind of set up, and how do you engage that? I inherited a way of thinking about the church that was pretty static. And in fact, it hadn't prepared me at all for the missionary kind of challenge of the modern Western city, which is more like I often likened it to a Papua New Guinea. Any modern city has, about 1,000 different people groups in it, legitimately, if you looked kind of with it missiological eyes. And then, but how do you grapple with that? On every hill there's a different kind of people group with a different language, So in Papua New Guinea, you have, it's a missiologist's nightmare. It's an anthropologist's dream. But, it's a real challenge. You have to translate the gospel onto the ground. So, that immersion into kind of a missionary approach just came more intuitively. And then I was paying for my sins, I might add, but recruited to work for our denomination, leading it, the kind of church planting, leadership development kind of side of it. And beginning to see the kind of, the challenges involved in engaging in the Western world, which things have shifted so radically, as pointed out, that we were in a post-Christian society, and yet, the ways we were thinking about the church and its purposes in the world were pretty much formatted in a time when, the church and the state were in a race. So began to see the big cracks in the system, really at a big level, as well as in the small level. So I think the combination really precipitated me to be both a church planter, taking a missionary approach to church planting rather than simply cookie cutter kind of approach, which at that time was pretty predominant. You would just assume, the ecclesiological kind of setup and just reproduce it. But, what it meant to be a missionary in a Western cities and Western world. Which led, of course, to writing a number of books for, Shaping of Things to Come First One, but Forgotten Ways, which is probably my centerpiece work, which everything elaborates from there. Quite a number after that, and then ended up in America doing the same kinds of things, trying to kind of help the church kind of engage the new missionary situation in which we find ourselves. My emphasis has largely been on Western settings, though.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit, Alan, because you're introducing a subject, of course, that we're interested in, and that is thinking about the Western world with missiological eyes. But that's not common in the West. We're not used to thinking of ourselves as needing the missionary to come and really think about how do we engage the culture in a relevant way. Tell us a little bit about your experience.
So it's been very interesting. So, like, you know, again, I guess it's to do with one's calling. But, you know, so for my role has largely been to try and wake the church up to its missionary identity and to adopt, therefore, a missionary approach to both understanding of the church, but also the problems that we face. And I think it resolves a huge amount of problems. So to be help the church engage in a paradigm shift, really, in terms of how we see ourselves. Interesting, the paradigms are classic things. I mean, we need them to negotiate the world, don't we? You know, the mind looks for the patterns, what is real. We agree together, actually, it's all socially constructed.
Right.
We agree together that this is what is real, and this is how we negotiate it. They're a mental map, as it were. And the problem is that by selecting one, we deselect other alternatives. You know, if you remember the picture of the old woman, young woman, you know, it's the classic paradigm picture, right? You know, but, you know, you look at it once, it's like an older woman looking at you, and you look again, and it's a younger woman with a feather in a cap looking away. You can't see, you know, by selecting one, you can't see the other. And the problem is that I think for me, it's been largely trying to awaken the church to the fact that the same thing we're looking at can be looked at fundamentally with a different paradigm. And to see ourselves in the lens of a much more primal, primitive way of looking at the church, which I see in the pages of the New Testament, which I call a movemental ecclesiology. The church as a movement, not as an institution. I'm not dismissing the value of structure in the institution, but I'm just saying, like, fundamentally, I think we're a movement that is able to scale and multiply and impact far more broadly than we've been able to do.
Well, isn't
so that's
that
been what I've been doing, really, you know, trying to awaken the church to that.
So has it worked?
It's hard work. You know, the interesting thing is that you don't, you know, technically, you don't need to convince the majority, actually. You only have to really get at those, you know, in terms of adoption curve. And if you think about how ideas accepted, the diffusion of innovation, as it were, Everett Rogers kind of did kind of seminal work on that in the 60s about how ideas are adopted and spread. And the thing is, you know, all you need is 16%, you know, to win the day. 16% on any given population, let's say evangelicals in the world. So, you know, all you need is 16%, but it's not a random sampling of 16%. It's 16% of your early adopter, your innovator early adopter types. And has it worked? I think to some degree there's been some shift. Yes, there has. I mean, it's interesting. It's for one of the other pieces of work I've done and relates to the Ephesian stuff that you guys were on about has been on the significance of the fivefold. Typology, it's been called the fivefold, I call it APIST, or 5Q. It's interesting that, like, in the last 10 years, everyone's using the language, which has been basically sanctioned language for, 2,000 years, 1,700 years.
Sure.
And you can't use the language of the apostolic or the prophetic, you know, but now people are using it. Now, do they understand it? No, not really. But at least the language is a precursor to understanding. It's very promising, guys. You know, so yes, there has been some adoption, and it's very exciting. And you don't need everyone; you just need the right people. And I think
right.
You've got something wrong.
So, for our listeners who today may be the very first time they've heard your name, what are when you say APEST, when you say 5Q? How do you understand those, again, so that people aren't just saying it without knowing what it means? How do you understand it in Ephesians, and what role do you think it plays with movements and the future of movements in the West?
Well, I'm the Lord of the long answer, guys. I should warn you.
That's right. Well, you were preceded by the Lord of the long question, so I have set you up for hours of conversation.
Oh, I could just say on the 5Q or the APIST conversation, I am pretty obsessed, and I'm totally, you know, won over. I don't know if you guys have read 5Q particularly. I mean, I've written four books on this now, and And I just feel the significance is so huge. But let me get prior to that. In Forgotten Ways was a book I wrote, oh, goodness, 14, 15 years ago. There's a new edition now. But in the Forgotten Ways, what I was trying to try and grapple with is what factors have got to come together to produce a movement that can go to scale and have long-term transformational impact. So looking at the early church, for instance, how in the first 300 years, what factors really came together to coalesce to or precipitate that kind of dynamic movement? Looking also at the contemporary example in the Chinese underground church. How does it grow from 2 million people in roughly 1950 to our best estimates now 120 million, that is 70, 80 years later, against all the odds? Both of them were persecuted movements. So they didn't have everything we think we need to get the job done, right? And there's six elements to that. I won't go through them now, but one of them is the APS typology. And so APS, of course, is an acronym, stands for Apostle, Prophet, Evangelist, Teacher, which is the language given to us in Ephesians 4, and I'll come to that. But you know, each of these has a distinctive contribution to the church's ministry that counterbalances the other and creates the kind of the intelligence and capacities for movements to take place. So I now say, like, if you want a movement that can go to scale and have high long-term impact, you have to have the ministry and leadership capacities to both initiate and sustain, and that's the key words there, to initiate or generate new form and to sustain and to get it operative and healthy. And that requires what I call generative form is apostolic, prophetic, evangelistic, who start new things for different reasons, each three of them, but they're all generative. And the others are more operative, that is, they take that which is given and make it better. And so the sustaining form comes in, the sustaining form has become the predominant one. So we only have the language of ministry as being that of the shepherd and teacher. Shepherd is a better translation, but pastor is. We use the word pastor in a much more unbiblical, generic way. You know, so, but if you know, we can use that. But shepherd and teacher is the only forms of ministry that most of the Western churches have got. In other words, we're perfectly designed to not be a movement, you know. So because those are not the generative forms, we've literally exiled the generative form, and so that is huge significance for the church, because Jesus, and this gets to the text, and I'll Lord of the long answer, but I'll get there now. The text in Ephesians links the giving of the fivefold gifts, and the language is aorist indicative, it's constitutional, once and for all, given to the church in the ascension, all five, not you can't cherry pick them, they come as a package, given to the church in the ascension, which is a commissioning act, as given so that we might, Paul attaches certain words to it, that we might, attain to the fullness of Christ. Oh my goodness, the fullness of Christ is attached to APS, that we might mature, that we might grow and build up all the good stuff, and that we might be the very people God intended us to be. So the assumption is if you mess around with the five typologies, you can never attain to what is promised in the text, which really becomes, and I think you look at history, I think we demonstrate it pretty well. So long answer, but I think it's worth us really reconsidering this.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
no, I was just reflecting on this, Alan, because I think that you have touched on something and you're unpacking some things that, of course, we're beginning to recognize that are not just church issues, but they're systemic issues, aren't they? Because as you brought up, I mean, we have really kind of propagated the shepherd teacher role. And we've done well at that, right? We can produce shepherds and teachers like nobody can produce, and yet what that ultimately does, as you're sharing, is that it kind of relegates those initiative roles, apostle, prophet, evangelist, to the sideline.
And so, like, you know, like classically, the apostolic, of course, is the missionary function. The apostolo, the sent one, is the one who is sent, goes into the, you know, to extend and impact beyond. It's the church planting function. It's the generative form. It's the innovation, you know, all that stuff that goes on to frontiers. The prophetic is to hold us accountable to the purposes of God, to make us attentive to God, because the church is given to, you know, being unfaithful. The evangelist being the recruiter to the call. So that's the inbuilt marketing department, if you will. You know, we've pretty much silenced that. We just have no language to even name those. You're not even allowed to use the language of the apostle and prophet in some of our churches. Mm. But my goodness, the Bible is filled with it. So if we're going to be biblical, the language of apostolic, 82 times apostle is used. The prophet, no kidding, the prophet is used, the word prophet in the New Testament is used 144 times. Mm. The word evangelist is 3 times. The word shepherd, once.
Yep. Wow.
The only time it is used for the ministry of believers, the noun form, is in the actual Ephesians text. And yet for us, the word pastor has become the catch-all phrase for every form of leadership. You have to wonder about our capacity to be theologos, to take theo words, God words, seriously, mm-hmm. and in forming our mentality and our mind.
Mm-hmm.
We'll teach you about 14 times. Now, they are important. Wow. I mean, all of them, in ascension, they're given to the church. But we cannot cherry pick them and then expect the results that the Bible points us towards.
Hmm. Very good.
Alan, what do you think is kind of the reason as to how the church has evolved over the centuries and just has resulted to this place in which we are reliant so much on the shepherd teacher role, and we have discounted the other important apostle prophet roles specifically? What have you seen contribute to that, and that has caused us to drift so far away from that first century New Testament church?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with just human dynamics, and you know, that we can use a lot of kind of organizational theory on this. I think it's very useful. It's to think about, like, you know, human beings always resist change and tend to kind of have a kind of penchant to try and create kind of something more stable and controllable. So one of the factors is purely kind of politics, really, about, you know, trying to kind of undermine those dimensions of the church's ministry that call us for constant adaptation and development and extension, that they create the discomfort. And all living systems tends towards equilibrium, so that they tend to take out the disequilibrium factors. And I mean, this accounts for the death of Jesus in some ways. I mean, he was disequilibrium in a system that was struggling to find equilibrium. So I think that's one of the factors. And it was, you know, but the death blow to our understanding of the fivefold was delivered by a guy called Clement. I think it was Clement of Alexandria. And the church was under threat from heresy at the time. And, you know, again, I think, you know, in a defensive mode, they were struggling with some of these kind of nomadic bands of prophetic apostles, you know, translocal kind of folk, trying to pin that down. And so they kind of went into a defensive position. And he, of course, they created the primacy of the shepherd teaching kind of roles and basically delegitimized the other ones. And that became normative. And of course, you know, there's a lot of things, again, I don't get too much detail, but became normative, and then the church kind of, you know, justified its ministry after that. But basically, if you use the word apostle, you know, in certain sectors of the church today still, you know, we don't use that word. And so, well, why? It's biblical, you know. What's wrong with the Bible words? You know, don't we love the Bible? Why can't we use Bible words? Because I mean, the classic thing, you know, like, we would have come from circles that I did anyway. The function of the apostles was to write the Bible and get out the way. Okay, how many apostles wrote the Bible then? where four or five. So the others were complete failures, were they?
They didn't contribute anything.
No, they did nothing. They just got, well,
waste of space.
Oh, then there was 12 of them, and that's the high church. Oh, yeah, yeah, there were 12, but what's Paul? 13 is like chopped liver. You know? Paul. And then there were other apostles, and one of them was a woman. So, like, you know, how do you factor that into it? So there's more
we do all kinds of theological or biblical gymnastics to get around that the role of the woman as an apostle, don't we?
Yeah. The female agency is so incredibly important in movements that change the world. I mean, like, you know, you're never going to do it with half the body missing in the equation. So that's a huge issue in itself. Movements, as you guys know, everyone's engaged as much as you can. Everyone's in the game. So, you know, we've professionalized the ministry to do that. You know, we need to give it back to where it belongs, in the people of God.
Mm. We've professionalized it to such a degree that we've paralyzed, it seems to me. Even our ability to arrive at movement.
Yeah. Yeah, and we specialized it, like you said. And by specializing the ministry, you become dependent on external agencies, where every church ought to be able to do everything it needs to do to get the job done. By specializing, you disempower the local church to do the very functions that the church only can do. And so, you know, you become dependent on external organizations that then become tails that wag the dog. There's so many incredible dangers in all that. You know, just over time, it's succumbed to so many problems.
Well, I have a question that's tangential to that, which seems to be, how have you, well, okay, just like you said, you wrote your kind of your major work, introducing a pest to the masses, getting people to talk about those 5 Q items. But I have noticed a whole lot of folk have embraced that almost in a half measure. Like they've taken all of the right words, and then they've tried to plug them into their existing systems. And so when they talk, again, like pastors, so are you an apostolic pastor? Are you a prophetic pastor? And so we keep trying to square peg round hole this whole thing. How do you see a way forward for the church to actually engage in movement dynamics through fully embracing 5Q?
This is a huge problem. I mean, like what we kind of talked about, how, you know, what in the last 10 years has been a huge adoption of the language, but the understanding lags. And so many of the movements I've been involved with, you know, now using the language, but I have, you know, what do they mean by that is, you know, often not very clear. And so one of the things I think is very, very important for us is to recognize the language and what it points us towards, and what is an apostle, not just guess of it, not just entrepreneur in an American sense, you know. And by the way, the evangelist can be entrepreneurial too. Actually, all can be, but I mean.
Right.
So just to equate entrepreneur with apostle is making a huge mistake. And so I think what we need to really become is very clear about the biblical language itself. And I often advise the church trying to grapple with it, just take your time. Look, God's waited 1,700 years for you to get this right. It takes another 2 years for you to get this right. So what? You know? But when you use the word apostle or prophet or evangelist, know what you mean by it and how they differ from each other. And I would say start with your team and study books or go to scripture and try and grapple with these words as they, you know, the revelatory impact of the words and how, what do they mean for us? And then once, and then start working, you know, within that. One of the big things, Andrew, is, and I think this is a very exciting movemental dynamic, is that when Paul in Ephesians says that these are given to the church. It says to each one of us, grace has been given as Christ has apportioned it, right? Now, I just take it that the people listening to this is not a seminary. It's not a group of leaders in the 21st century. It's a group of God's ordinary people. And there were slaves and women present, so they were disempowered, some of them, you know, in broader society. I love the New Testament for that, by the way. It gives equal agency to all of God's people, whether you're a slave, a woman, or a man. You know, you're given agency. It's fantastic. To each one of us is given. And then so then it goes on to elaborate the fivefold kind of dynamic. And so I'm assuming that means all of us are there somewhere. You know, Jesus is cutting the cake and he's giving it out. And, you know, I wonder what I got. And you should think that. So everyone in our church, I would say, is given something of the nature of atheist is given to all of God's people. So some of it might not be developed. In fact, I would argue in our churches it's not because we can't even name it, but they're there, latent. And I think one of our challenges is to be able to name it in all of God's people and then develop leadership pathways to develop these people. It's really a discipleship issue. And that way we bolster, you know, what God is already doing in the church. What Jesus is doing in and through his people, we all cooperate with him because that's exactly what he was. That's the powerful thing, by the way. Jesus is the fully embodied atheist. Mm-hmm. He bequeaths us to the body of Christ, which is the imagery of the Ephesians in this, so that we might attain to the fullness of Christ. They're all linked. Mm. Now I'm going off, aren't I?
Yeah, no, that's good.
Too exciting. That's too exciting.
Yeah, well, you know what? It makes me ask this question, Alan, and I don't know if, I mean, we haven't found the answer, and I don't know if, I'm sure there is an answer somewhere, but it makes me wonder, do we even actually have the, and I don't know what other word to use, but do we have the system or the structure or the capacity to, within the existing Western church, to effectively instill in the Western church this apest language and actually see something change?
You know,
in other words, are we a part of the problem,
right,
in some way that we're not able to, you know, get past the structures that we've been accustomed to for 1700 years to get to this place where we can see these things affected?
You know, it's so exciting at the moment. I have to say that this is, to me, the most generative conversation, in at least in what I'm doing at the moment. There's no fundamental resistance to this anymore. Seriously, you know, I've stood before groups of academics and said, look, if you want to correct me, you need to do this now. Because I'm happy to be corrected, but if not, and if I'm correct, you need to repent.
Yeah.
Yeah, the funny thing is that actually we're seeing this now all the way through in academic circles too. So like Asbury Seminary, on their front page of their website, Affirms the Fivefold, you go in there and it talks about the need for all these. One, actually the guy leading it at the moment was a missionary. So he can see it because he knows it from a missionary
perspective. Yeah.
And we're even with them doing what we call a 5Q Institute. So we're actually developing up to the doctor ministry level. You know, so that's phenomenal. And that's not just, I mean, it's just one. We're seeing this adoption of this is historic, in my opinion. But now we need clarity on it. We need scholarship and learning and people to kind of, you know, help get clarity in the church. But I think we've come to the realization that what we've inherited will not be able to get the job done. We're on the back foot in the decline in every Western setting, and we're perfectly designed for that. And we can't blame, people don't believe anymore. People are people. They, you know, they're essentially religious, but they're not looking at the church. You can't blame them. We need to look at ourselves and look at the things that we're doing that are blocking God's, you know, what God wants to do through us. And one of them is our suppression of atheist typology.
Alan, you just said something. I want to be sure that we catch it and maybe unpack it a little bit. But you said that, and I want to be sure that I understand, you said that we're perfectly designed to see what we're seeing today in the West. Wait, unpack that a little bit.
So this idea of design, I think it's a fascinating concept that, you know, it's a fruit and tree thing. You can actually work back to what an organization or person is producing. You can work back and assume that Well, if it's producing that outcome, it's actually designed to produce those outcomes, right? One of the less sexy definitions for organization is the mobilization of bias, not BS, but bias. It could be BS. BS.
Classic.
So the idea is that when we start an organization, we design it to achieve certain outcomes. In other words, it's designed for those purposes. If we're producing the kinds of churches that we produce, well, you can't blame any outside factors. You have to assume that it's all in the design. And so we are perfectly designed to achieve what we're currently achieving. If churches are in decline, I suggest to you that it's problems of what they're doing that is producing the decline. And they need to look at themselves and I call them movement killers or movement blockers, things that are blocking the movemental capacities in God's people that God has given us. Gates of hell do not prevail against the church, right? So if we're not doing that, then there's things that we're doing that are suppressing that movemental capacity, and we need to look at that and take them out.
I think that is such a key point, Alan. And we miss that, don't we? And I wonder sometimes if we're so close to it, maybe we're not seeing it.
I love saying this. Everyone likes this. Yeah, it's impossible for it's hard for man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it.
Wow, wow.
And the problem is that we are the insiders, and we're the beneficiaries of the system. It's hard to understand something when our salary and our sense of self-worth and our everything we've got is built into the system. So we need to develop some distance from that, critical distance, prophetic, yeah. Actually, prophetic, critical distance to be able to look at things with new eyes. And it takes some courage to do that. But I think without doing that, we're never going to, I mean, we know the definition of organizational insanity, that we're trying to achieve significantly different things by doing the same thing better. So we have to look at what we're doing. And one of the big things for me, Michael, is this notion of latent capacity, latent potential. And forgotten ways, I call it apostolic genius. It's latent within the church. It's a work of the Spirit. And that, I believe, we've designed by Jesus intrinsically to achieve world transformation. It's latent in all God's people. How is it that China, after 2,000 years of Christianity in that continent, had grown to 2 million people, but in the grand scheme of things, not very effective, and in small percentage population, at the time when all the institution, what they've relied on so strongly, is taken out, then they go to scale. So what was going on there? I had to come, and in fact, the phenomenology, and you guys would love that word, right? The phenomenology is precisely the same as that of the New Testament. When you look at it, I would argue it's precisely the same. There's a few insignificant differences, but the phenomenon is the same, which means that the ecclesiology, which is what you guys are about, actually, it's all there in the way that Jesus has designed us. It's kind of latent within us, and it needs release. And work with God has done in us and wants to do through us.
I love that.
There's just so much here to chew on, Ellen. This is incredible. You mentioned a few things of just as we're kind of looking at some of those key blockers, the things that we cannot see, perhaps the organizational things at which we, within ecclesiology, within the church, we are continuously doing, propagating, upholding, that actually might be preventing or likely are preventing movements from taking place. Could you make some connections or even list a few of them that are off the top of your head as to what you see those particular things are, and how do they relate, or how are they inspired by that first century church, if they do at all?
Okay. Actually, it's a great historical example of what I call movement killers. It's not great. It's actually sad. But in the The Churching of America, which is was written by what's his name, sociologist? I'll come back to it. These are two premises.
What was the title of the book?
The Churching of America. The guy did the Rise of Christianity.
Rodney Stark.
Rodney Stark and Roger Fink. Yeah, these two dudes are the dudes, right? What he does is the Churching of America, and it was first in the Journal of Scientific Study of Religion, so it's a well-documented piece. And he was interested in the rise of early Methodism, actually Baptists as well, but let me stay with the Methodists. And, of course, Wesley came to America twice. The first time was complete failure. The second time he had this encounter with the Holy Spirit, and he'd come across, and within 50 years of his arrival on the shores of America, 35% of Americans were Methodists within 50 years. That's phenomenal. And of course, even more phenomenal because America was shifting west, you know, was the westward impulse, so that this was all on the frontier in these crazy outposts, you know, the lawless, you know, kind of place. And so how did they do that? Well, the question is, like, Methodism was obsessed with disciple making. Classes, bands, all that, societies, all that stuff, it was not negotiable. If you're going to be, even before you were Christian, if you're involved with the Methodists, you were put into discipleship groupings. And there was thorough, you know, it was real stuff, you know, the real
deal. It was walking the line between indoctrination and discipleship.
Yes, technically it was about holiness, isn't it?
But that's right.
The holiness, holy clubs.
But what they meant by holiness was not just, you know, it was personal holiness, yes, which is your relationship with Jesus, but also social holiness, which was your justice obligations to bring about wholeness in the world. Anyway, it's a remarkable movement. So they were built on discipleship. And then of course, they had the church planters, what they called circuit riders, which were ordinary people who did three-month boot camp training. Sounds very much like the Bible, right? And they'd get on a horse and ride into the West, and they would plant churches, right? And then they would circuit around to the churches that they planted, and they would do the same thing. Anyone want to kind of be a circuit rider? People put up their hands, get on, and they give them 3 months training, set them out, and then they had this incredible church planting movement. I mean, it was remarkable. So by 1850, this is interesting, 1850, they got to 35% of America's population. Again, I mean, phenomenal.
It's amazing.
And then, of course, in 1850, it just goes flat. And so these two sociologists begin to say, what happened there? This is what they discovered, right? The Methodists, who were always engaging all of God's people, they were very strong, and they engaged with slaves and women as well. They empowered them, right, and stood for them. But they were ragged on and being teased by the Episcopalians and the Presbyterians. Oh, you uncouth people don't know your Greek, Hebrew, and Latin. Ha, 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 right? And so they were mocking them relentlessly. And so the leaders of the Methodist movement at the time decided, oh, we had enough of this mocking. We're going to establish training institutions equal and better than our religious detractors, right? And they then built what became Duke and, you know, some really substantial kind of academic institutions. So they flatlined. Yeah. So they took the church planters out of circuit and made them study 4 years of bachelor divinity studies, Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and all the rest of that stuff.
It always comes down to the seminary. The seminary is the problem.
Perfectly designed to achieve what we're currently achieving.
You know, I just think that's a brilliant comment and really something for us to reflect on. And that's difficult for us to do. I think, you know, we get so used to being in a system and we're products. I know I'm a product of the system, and I hate to go back and say, well, gosh, I spent all this money getting the education that I have and then realize that it's
a Michael, problem. I think what it is, bro, is that the danger of the seminary is to say that you have to have 8 years of study, because that's what it is, right? You have to have 2 degrees now to get what you were given when you were baptized into Jesus Christ.
Mm.
And an agency of being an agent of the king, right? So your ministry is given to you by your new birth. You don't have to work back for that. I think the problem is more with ordination, and that, you know, the seminary is bound up with the ordination process. But besides that, it's a non-discipleship form, which is really the killer. By the way, just back to our historical example. So in 1850 was the seminary, and now, of course, the professionalization of the clergy. What happened in 1860 was, of course, the Civil War, mm-hmm. and the same leaders, I think, decided at that time, and I can understand this in a weird way, that Christians were fighting against Christians, so that they suspended the need for being parts of discipleship bands. So they suspended the discipleship. Here's the problem. They never reinstituted it. They substituted it for Sunday school curriculum. And that was a killer.
Yeah.
Because discipleship is not education. It's not the same thing. And they've been in decline to the population ever since. Percentage-wise. Interesting.
Yeah. That's been a... I can't remember who we had that conversation with, but I feel like we had that conversation recently. And it was something that we were kind of starting to kind of put some pieces together, realizing that there's a disconnect in the term discipleship in itself. And we have intellectualized it. It's become knowledge. It's study. It's school. It's you go to a discipleship class and we learn about the Bible. We learn about Jesus. We learn about the faith, but we rarely put it into practice. And it's disconnected actually from the apostolic movement of these are the people. We are apprentices of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And we have really seemed to neuter that from the original intent and what we see obviously clearly being biblical. And you just, again, confirmed it for us, even by just using a recent history here.
So, yeah, so the, so in forgotten ways, again, I presume you, by the way, but, there are six factors I've mentioned. APES is one of them. The others are, I'll quickly mention them, but only simply because I think these factors are a phenomenology, that is, that wherever you see the phenomenon of exponential movement, you will find, I believe, and I think the model holds now, that you will see these six elements of work. An absolute centrality of Jesus, and in the confession of Jesus as Lord, and everything that that contains, Christology, covenant and kingdom, all that stuff come together around this particular person. That's the central piece that gives the vibe of the movement, and it sets it up as a Jesus movement. It's absolutely centered around the significance of Jesus. The next one is called discipleship and disciple making. And discipleship is having clarity of what we mean by the word discipleship. Disciple making is making sure that we are, as leaders at least, creating systems that know how to do that, that you're actually factoring it in, deliberately designing it into the organization to make sure that it achieves those outcomes. Mm. It doesn't happen willy-nilly. It needs design. It needs leadership, policy, strategy, all that stuff to kind of make it happen. Because the churches that we generally are part of are designed around non-discipleship. They're actually designed around attendance, not about discipleship. And that's a huge problem.
Mm.
The attendance is in discipleship mind. And then the other ones are just for the sake of it, I think just to... Maybe the audience might benefit. Next one is missional incarnational impulse. That is, missional is the sentness of the church. Feeling ourselves as being sent out, that, you know, the purpose of God. This is, you know, our best missional theology, you know, of our sentness. And then incarnation is going in the way of Christ. That is, you know, into the neighborhood, 30 years, you know, of witness, but it's contextualization processes. Outward deepening, and so you see the movement begins to extend. APEST mentioned organic systems has to do with the organizational style, the type of organization that we have. Movements organize, but they organize differently. They don't centralize power and function, they push it outwards. That every agent in the system is able to do as, you know, can reproduce the whole, right? So you don't specialize. Everyone's a generalist. You keep it from becoming siloed, you know, so and that you keep it simple enough to reproduce. And that's all fascinating. I'm a geek enough to really like that stuff, but it's really important because organizations can either make or break us, right?
Sure.
And so we need to be on top of that. The other one would be what I call liminality and communitas. So liminality is the conditions of risk, danger, challenge, ordeal that precipitate a new way of being together. That they communitas is the kind of community that forms in the context of an ordeal, challenge, risk, that joins us as comrades. And it relates to the way that people, it's not just like fellowship, it's a bond that's created that really creates the church. Mm-hmm. It's vigorous, you know? And that all six of these are necessary for moving to take place. And I would argue that whenever we work against any of these, we hinder the movement capacity that is latent in God's people. So non-discipleship is a movement killer of the first proportion. And truthfully, I think most of us haven't even got a clue what discipleship is, let alone what to do. And so most churches are already, if you fail in discipleship, you fail everywhere. Everywhere.
And if we don't have an operating, working, successful, or even a proper, I should say, definition of what a disciple is and what a disciple does, then, I mean, why did we open our doors today?
Mm.
Yeah,
well, and a great challenge to so many of our churches, which we, you know, we love and work with, is that what you win them with, you win them too. And we use really entertainment now. You know, or go for it. Then next week you have to be better than you have to entertain them more next week than you did this week because you know what?
Yeah,
Hillsong comes to town, they're gonna hand your ass back to you on the platter, right?
Yeah. Oh, man.
You know what?
Hair, I'd be pulling it out right now.
Been there.
You're so on.
No, it's a whip for our backs, isn't it, guys? I mean, like, what entertainment? So, again, what you win them with, you win too. And I think is if Jesus goes about is selecting disciples and investing, knowing that, yes, might not in the small, in the first instance, it's small, but you can build on that. We know from movements, you guys know this, right, is that the proportion of your discipleship base is the, you can build on your disciples. If you have no disciples, you have nothing to build on. If you double your discipleship base, you know, if you think of it like a triangle, you get much more volume. Your base is everything, and so your discipleship base is absolutely critical in for launching and sustaining movements.
Sure. And, you know, and I wonder, as you're talking, it makes me wonder if somehow we've fooled ourselves to think that maybe what we are doing, you know, with in the absence of the apostle, prophet, and evangelist, and the primacy on the shepherd teacher, if somehow we've convinced ourselves that that's all that's necessary, and if we can do that, then we think that we're making disciples. When in reality, we're almost making, I don't know what we're making, but we're certainly not making disciples.
Yeah,
so or handicapped disciples, perhaps.
I think this is something you talk about in your book, Michael, coming out shortly, is that we're probably using the wrong scorecard. I mean, in all seriousness, we look at the shepherd teachers, and the shepherd teachers are managing to put butts in seats. And so if the shepherd teachers puts butts in seats, then we're not failing, right? Mm-hmm. But we've been assessing the wrong thing. We've been assessing not are we making disciples, it's do we have the attendance, do we have the buildings, and do we have the cash flow? Because as long as we have that, then that means we're winning. And I think, Alan, you have made me sad all anew in regards to the fact that we are getting the outcome.
Well, you know, like
exactly
Alan,
like we were planning.
Like Alan said before we came on air, one of his primary tasks is to ruin the lives of all of us.
Yeah.
So we're glad that we've achieved that, Alan. Andrew, thank you for doing that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the metrics thing is so fascinating because, again, like I said, budget is a theological document. Mm-hmm. It says what we value, right? So where do we spend our money? It'll give you a good clue to what you think is important.
Yeah.
And most of our money goes to weekend services, you know, let's be honest. I mean, so you, that says it all, right? If we really value something, we measure it. And when what we measure improves, right? That was Drucker's great insight. And I say, like, a missional church measures its effectiveness not just by its impact inside the church, butts, bucks, and attendance, all that stuff, but its impact beyond the church. And you can measure these things, of course, right? Because you measure your impact on broader society, you know, on suicide rates or addiction or things like that outside the church should be measured, that what the church is doing is having impact. You can measure this. And then once you measure it, it does, you know, it's a missional measure, missional metrics that we need to measure. So, yes, wow. Absolutely.
Alan, are you seeing, just with your work with all of your different movements and organizations that you have an opportunity to interact with, are you seeing some places in the West where you're starting to see these movement dynamics really starting to take place and take shape? Where are they successfully doing that at?
So, again, I'm bound to the typology, and I think it's at least what God has given me to work with, is the six elements of MDNA, which I've mentioned now. When I look at the West, the theory has it that all six must come together, and by coalescing, they create an emergent phenomenon called a movement. What we're seeing in Western settings now is, what I'm seeing, is a number of organizations that are getting 1, 2, 3 really good, and 4 maybe, and moving towards the others, because they now can name them because they've got something to look at and to understand. But there's definitely movement going on. So, like, you know, whether you take anything from, you know, what the Soma community's New Thing Network is quite remarkable. It's got a lot to learn, but it's got an incredible energy. The New Thing Network is Chicago-based. I think you guys know them, don't you? Mm-hmm. They've doubled themselves every year since their inception. You know, now they have a global impact, and that's phenomenal. And they're doing a lot of things right, and they're working hard to correct things. You know, but now it's non-reproducible American form of churches, and they're looking at micro churches now, which is, I think, really important. And it's a both and phenomenon. They're taking APIS typology. They're trying to work that out now. They're better missional than they are incarnational. They need to look at the incarnational moments. How do they embed the church into local society? So we're seeing that kind of thing. I'm working with City to City at the moment, based in New York City with, you know, Tim Keller's mob. And we're applying a lot of these type of, you know, just trying to help them engage the city of New York City, which is a real challenge because it's kind of America, but it's not America, you know, and it's like it's more like Europe, and yet it's not, you know, it's not. So, and yet the problem is most of the people who try and do church planting in New York City do it along the model that we work in Dallas. You know, nothing wrong with Dallas, it just doesn't.
There's everything wrong with Dallas, but anyway, go on.
There's the Houstonian.
You know this, Andrew, like you can plant a cross in the ground in Dallas and 2 weeks later you've got a church. At least 4 or 5 people hanging around it. You can't do that in New York City.
No.
And the problem is that methodology is just not going to work. New York demands a missionary response, an approach. So we actually now doing a thing called AQ, which is the apostolic quotient. We're taking 18-20 of the key leaders through 1-year learning journey to think through the lens of apostolic approaches to the city. So very exciting, and there's, you know, a whole lot of program stuff we do, experimental forms of church planting. There is change happening. It's just it's a little bit here, a little bit there, but enough of it. Eventually, when it will demonstrate viability if they're able to get it together and go to scale, people will pay attention.
Alan, do you think this is going to be something that you will see come to full fruition in your lifetime, or do you think this is a much longer game?
Are you applying that Alan is old?
Yeah, I am not applying that he is old.
Dude, he's our guest.
I'm asking. That's a fair jab. I'm asking only because Michael and I recently went to the think tank hosted by the Send Institute at the Billy Graham Center here in Chicago. Jeff Christofferson was there to help lead us through some things. And one of the things that we've referenced a few times on this podcast that we've talked about is this, we did a bit of a case study on the Church of 2050 and just kind of thinking about the next really now 30 years of church and what that's going to look like for the future of leadership in the church and well beyond that. And there seems to be a bit of a stench in the room, if you will, that says this is going to have to take some time to get played out. And I guess that's my, that's where I'm asking the question is you're starting to kind of bring some of these pieces together, and I'm asking you what you're starting to see or feel or sense.
I feel that, if I look at 2050, I mean, all I know is that the church that we're currently engaging now, largely across America, is not going to be.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be. It's not going to survive. And I think the last, five or so years, I think it precipitated now a major turn towards massive decline, which is already experienced in Europe. And I do like to remind Americans, particularly, that essentially the kind of form of church that we largely operate from is a European understanding of church. We're a European derivative. And I say to people, if you want to know the future of the European form of church, hey, take a vacation. Go to Europe. It's fantastic. And, you can, and the dollar's good and strong at the moment. Have a great vacation. Go and see if you can find viable churches anywhere. No, there's a few. I'm not dismissing folks, but not really. And that's the future of the prevailing form if we do not change. We have it right there for us. It doesn't even work in Europe where it was formulated. How do you expect it's going to be able to survive? And we're now beginning to experience that kind of Europeanization of our societies. And so I think it's going to accelerate. Now, to the answer. I think it's late in the game, but we are seeing some change. And whether it's in my lifetime, I see some of it now, a little bit. Like I say, the new thing guys on the team. I see some of it. And people like yourselves, the very fact that, we're having this conversation and there's heartfelt, I feel it, agreement on a fundamental level. Is hopeful, and that Jeff and the Send Institute, which I'm actually part of, but I can never get to as much of it. There's no doubt on that Send Institute, we're talking all this stuff out. Mm-hmm. And it's a wide selection of people. I think there's signs of hope, but it's late in the game.
Yeah. I think that's what we're starting to feel too. You've had a chance to start to kind of read some of the material that Michael's book really is starting to come out soon. I know he sent you an advanced copy and you've had some chance to read. What have been some of your just thoughts about some of the things that you've been thinking through and the things you've written on previously and some of the things that Michael has been thinking through and some of the conversations that we've been having? How do those two worlds kind of interact in your mind?
I haven't read terribly much of it, but I have browsed it, and then I'll go back and do a decent read. But I'm just very thankful for it. I wished, in some senses, this kind of work needed to be. I wished I had it when I was trying to grapple with the Forgotten Ways, for instance. Like, what I think is most important here is the movemental understanding of the church, which I believe is a New Testament phenomenon. It is the New Testament church was movemental, but at the very core of it was. And I think there's not near enough of lighting it with an academic strength that this book has got that substantiates that. So there's a huge vacuum there, and I think I really hope that Michael's book will be well read. It's done by a missiologist who's looking at New Testament, and I think what the strength is, Michael, is that you're really giving us a thorough look at New Testament ecclesiology from a movement's perspective. And I think I can't think of any other book that's done that. I mean, mine has tried it from a very different perspective, but it's not that historical New Testament, theology. I'm not that.
I appreciate that.
I'm very grateful for it, Brian. I wish it was around years ago, but I'm really happy to be writing.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And I'm fully aware that there's been so much out there. And Alan, you've been a wonderful contributor to us, helping us to think about mission and movement and really rethink the shaping of the church. And just on this podcast, the things that you've shared, I think, are so key to helping us to understand. And I'm hoping that as we continue to interact, and I'm very hopeful that that's going to happen, but as we continue to interact, that we'll begin to see this coalescing of these ideas where we're bringing together good biblical, missiological, alongside of sociological and historical research. And I mean, just think what could happen as these things come together. Maybe in your lifetime, Alan, we will see something happen. Or not applying at all that you're old. I'm pretty close behind you.
I feel like I'm turned 60, but I feel like in the world that we're living in, I feel like I'm old and grumpy now. but yes, mate, geek enough. Thomas Kuhn, he kind of wrote his book on the structure of scientific revolution, which really kind of so foundational in paradigm shift, understanding the nature of paradigms and paradigm shifts, says this, and I think this relates to this conversation, and one I'd love to get you involved in too. I think all three of you need to be there as the Movement Leaders Collective, because we're trying to bring people like this together. You know, there's a coalescing, and I think it's very exciting. So he says, Kuhn says that there's first of all, it begins to be like a questioning of the basic assumptions of the prevailing paradigm. He calls it, and interestingly, it's by the best thinkers, the ones who've mastered it. They sense the anomaly in the system. And that's the word he uses, anomaly. They think something's wrong here. But because they're the best thinkers, they can see the anomalies. Most others don't see it, right? And then he says they come together. He says this causes a roaming of the mind, a lovely phrase, a roaming of the mind. And then it begins to see that these people begin to come together and compare notes. And they create a kind of new, by actually sharpening each other and comparing notes and enhancing each other, they begin to kind of formulate the new paradigm, which then is evicted from the prevailing paradigm.
Mm.
And then it becomes its own and has to undergo the same paradigm shift later on. Others come to new insights. But I think actually what we are seeing is right now, this conversation is a good example of this. You know, we've all sensed the anomaly in the system of the Western Church, and now we need to compare our notes and bring academic rigor to this as well, intellectual engagement at the higher level.
Mm.
And so I think that's happening. I think I'm very hopeful in that school. We had a great time last year at the Movie Leaders Collective. We had people from as far as New Zealand, and then we had Catholics, we had Anglicans, we had everything in between, Baptists, independent Baptists. It was the most weirdest group of people. And the idea is that we were to share our insights, and that the room itself is the genius. We call it seniors, right? It's not like anyone. It wasn't a conference. It's a we think the answer's in the room. It's actually the room itself is the genius, right? And that we can resolve each other's problems by actually submitting to what God is doing. And it's a fascinating experience. And so we're having our next one in May, and you guys have got to come. I've already given Michael the information, but I'd love to have you. I think you guys would love it. You can interview everyone you want to, harvest all the learnings,
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you, Alan, for the invite. That's really, really appreciate that. So
absolutely, we're going to book
it. We'll put it on the calendar.
I'll get you the information, guys. I think I've got all the information.
Yep. Yeah.
That'd be awesome. Great. Well, thank you, Alan. Well, Alan, we want to respect your time, and we're just truly grateful for just for this privilege and the opportunity to be able to have this one-on-one time with you today. And thanks just for filling our heads with all sorts of incredible thoughts and exploding thoughts and exploding minds. And I think too, just for our audience, this is a great opportunity for us just to even go back and replay and slow it down even at times and kind of take some more notes about just to give us some thoughts as to where to go next. And I think one of the things that we've loved cultivating here with Ephesiology is how we're doing theology in community and really exploring that first century church, really exploring God's word and beginning to, as you said, discovering that perhaps the answer is the room. It's everybody together, collectively working together and mining the truth and hearing from the Holy Spirit to understand where we go from here. And I think we are have exciting days ahead of us, but obviously not without its bumps and bruises along the way.
There are anomalies to move out.
Yeah, more power to you guys. Anything I can do to kind of advance what you guys are doing is helping people, you know, think through movements and the New Testament lens. It's very promising, and I think it's it's the right time. Mm-hmm. So I wish you all the best.
Appreciate Thanks that, Alan. Hey, how do our listeners get in contact with you? What's the best way that they can follow you, or where can you point them?
Well, I think the best thing is the work I'm doing today with the 5Q Collective. So it's 5QCentral.com. I have an alanhirsch.net. There's a contact form. It's alanhirsch.org, sorry. And contact form comes out. An email with forgottenways@gmail.com. And other than that, I'm probably easily going to be
Great. Well, expect thousands and thousands of emails.
That's what we hope.
That's awesome. Well, Alan, thank you again for your time today, and thanks for joining us. And we just also want to thank our listeners and our audience for being a part of the conversation today. And of course, we invite you, our listener, to continue to join us on our Facebook page at Ephesiology, and of course online at ephesiology.com. With that, for Michael, Andrew, Alan, and myself, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.